Some reflections this afternoon on another sutta, another teaching that feels like it ties the threads of these three perceptions: impermanent, unreliable, not self, together into a way in which they are different facets of an understanding. The sutta is the Kacchanagata Sutta from the Samyutta Nikaya. And I brought two translations with me, partly because the language in certain parts of one feels more resonant to me, and then in other parts, the other language feels more resonant. There was actually one section of the Bhikkhu Bodhi translation that I could not parse. I was like, what does this mean? Let me look at Tan Jeff's translation. So I'll go back and forth between them. So the sutta begins, Kacchana. I believe Kacchana is a monk, because it says the Venerable Kacchana approaches the Buddha, and he asks a question: what is right view? In what way is there right view? And so right view here in this sutta, I mean, right view is the factor of the Eightfold Path that begins the Eightfold Path. It is the perspective that we have to start with before we even begin to bring awareness to our experience, the perspective, the view of what we are aiming towards needs to be there. This is where the whole mind begins to turn towards seeing this experience as human experience, seeing how suffering is created, understanding these misperceptions. And so the right view at the beginning of the Eightfold Path, my understanding of the right view at the beginning of the Eightfold Path is very much that it is in the realm of the first two kinds of wisdom, Suttamayapanya, Chintamayapanya, the wisdom of hearing, the wisdom of reflecting on. And so that's where we begin. And then at the end of the Eightfold Path, it ends with right concentration, but there is a way in which the culmination of the Eightfold Path is the direct understanding of those views that were just previously reflected on or heard. And so it is the culmination of the Eightfold Path is a different way of understanding the world. And so this sutta seems to describe right view in terms of a description of how somebody sees the world, how somebody experiences the world when their mind is free. Another reflection for just a moment on right view. As I thought through that, I remembered a quote from a scholar who wrote a book called The Notion of Ditti, which is the word Pali word for view, The Notion of Ditti in Theravada Buddhism. And he, Paul Fuller, says this about the Buddha's teaching, about how what the culmination of that is. So he says, the Buddha's teaching is not concerned with whether or not there's a self, but with the fact that the craving is the cause of dukkha, Knowledge of this is right view. Knowledge consists in knowing the cessation of craving, and this is the knowledge of things as they are. When the texts teach that one should strive to attain right view, they are arguing for the attainment of a very specific attitude, a way of apprehending things without any form of attachment. Right view is not simply another view as opposed to wrong view, nor is it the rejection of all views. The opposite of wrong view is of a different nature, not a mere correction, but a different order of seeing. So that phrase, that right view, is a different order of seeing. It's a different way of apprehending the world. Different ways to describe that, in this case, describing that right view in terms of understanding the cessation of craving. Another way to put it is the understanding of impermanent, unreliable, not self. So this sutta that where the person asks about right view, the Buddha decides to answer Kachana not with the basic usual teaching. One of the most familiar teachings about right view is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And so he doesn't respond to Kachana in this way. Instead, he says this. This world, Kachana, for the most part depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. But for one who sees the arising of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. So we can kind of linger here and unpack this a little bit. So he says that most beings, ordinary beings, depend upon the idea of existence or the idea of non-existence. And the commentaries say that this refers to two foundational kind of beliefs at the time of the Buddha, that either of eternalism, that there's kind of an eternal existing self, or annihilationism, that there is nothing. And the Buddha, and in some ways it feels like these two, the notion of existence in regard to the world, that's like things exist, that's a form of permanence. There's something to take a stand on. It's a notion of something existing. And it feels like the notion of non-existence is also maybe paradoxically also a form of permanence, a belief in the non-existence of things. So the Buddha says that seeing things as they actually are, when one sees that things are arising, witnessing the arising of phenomena, the notion of things not existing just wouldn't occur to somebody. That just doesn't make any sense when you notice the arising nature of experience. The notion that nothing exists makes no sense. And then he says, and then seeing how conditions lead to the cessation of experience, lead to the falling apart of experience, when we see that things, even as they're arising, they fall apart. that the seeing of the falling apart, why would you impute any existence, any stability, any thingness to that? This kind of seeing, he says, it'll come to it in a moment. He says, this is right view, this kind of seeing, the seeing that, you know, the idea of existence, the idea of non-existence don't make any sense when we actually see things as they are. Coming into being, things arising, the conditions arising and creating an experience. There's a sense of, there's not a sense of nothing. Maybe there would be an inclination towards a sense of something there, but as soon as we see the falling apart, that inclination also becomes nonsensical. And a little bit later in the text, he uses the teaching of dependent origination as a way of explaining or pointing to how things come together, the arising of things, and also that when, you know, when ignorance arises, mental formations, consciousness, name and form, sense bases, whole chain arises. But it's not a thing, it's a set of processes. And the falling apart, when ignorance falls apart, when we see through those misperceptions, that whole chain of conditions falls apart. So I'll read that again. This world, for the most part, depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. But for one who sees the arising of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, and I'll take a moment to just point to that word, the world, elsewhere in the suttas, the Buddha uses that word and clearly defines it as the world of our experience. He says, what I mean by the world is the experience of this fathom-long body. And so the world here is everything experienced by the senses, by the five aggregates. It's just this kind of tumbling of the five aggregates. For one who sees the arising of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there's no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there's no notion of existence in regard to the world. He goes on, and I'm going to switch to Thanissaro's translation, Thanissaro Bhikkhu's translation. By and large, Kacchana, this world is in bondage to its attachments, clingings, and biases. But such a one as this, that is, such a one seeing in this way, does not get involved with or cling to these attachments, clingings, fixations of awareness, biases, or obsessions, nor are they resolved on self. So these words to me are pretty evocative of the types of minds that arise in dependence on these misperceptions, taking things to be permanent, reliable, self. We're in bondage, believing, getting things is where happiness lies, in bondage to attachments, clingings and biases. That really struck me, that word. We do cling to our biases. We cling to our views, our perspectives. We don't want to let in other perspectives. Such a one as this does not get involved with or cling to these attachments, clingings, fixations of awareness. That phrase I liked too, fixations of awareness. And we know that feeling. That's kind of the tarrying, one of the subtler tarryings. Like, yep, that's where we land, even for just a moment. And then, are they resolved on self. And the language that Bhikkhu Bodhi uses for this particular sentence, one does not take a stand about myself. That has a kind of an evocative feeling to me, does not take a stand on self. It evokes that kind of quality of the impermanent nature of these arisings and passings. There's nowhere to land. That, in a sense, the sense of self is a landing or a taking a stand with some aspect of experience, some aspect of these biases, some aspect of these attachments, taking a stand with that. Yep, this is where I'm going to hang my hat. This is where I'll find happiness, even if I know it's only for, you know, the next 10 minutes. And then I'll find another one that I can attach to. So it does not take a stand about myself. And then there was another sutta that this connected with, and I had not I think I had read it, but I hadn't really landed with this particular sutta before, and it was referred to in some of the notes in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. And this speaks to this very same area of taking a stand, of that sense of self, of what we do there. So this is a conversation between a bhikkhuni, Vajira, and Mara. In the morning, the bhikkhuni Vajira dressed, and taking bowl and robe, entered Savati for alms. When she had walked for alms and had returned from her alms round, after her meal, she went to a grove for the day's abiding. She sat down at the foot of a tree. Then Mara, the evil one, desiring to arouse fear, trepidation, and terror in the bhikkhuni Vajira, desiring to make her fall away from concentration, approached her and addressed her in verse. Here's what Mara said. By whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of the being? Where has the being arisen? Where does the being cease? Sounds kind of similar to some of the things the Buddha asks. But the word, apparently, I looked in the Pali for the word for being here. It wasn't a word that I was familiar with. It was satesu, I think, something like that. So it may have a more of a reification, a reified sense of an existing being in this verse, as opposed to the kind of the sense of being that is the tumbling on of the aggregates. And so Vajira thought, who is it that's recited this verse? Then it occurred to her, this is Mara who's recited this verse, desiring to arouse fear, trepidation, and terror in me. And the nun, Vajira, having understood, replied to Mara, saying, Why do you now assume a being? Mara, is that your speculative view? This is a heap of sheer formations. Here no being is found. Just as with an assemblage of parts, the word chariot is used. So, when the aggregates exist, there is the convention of being. This speaks to the kind of the way in which conventionally we feel like, you know, it's like the river. There's no stability at all in a river. The water's not the same moment to moment. The stuff on the floor of the silt on the floor of the river bottom is being continually carried away. Even after a flood or something, that the whole course of the riverbed is going to change, possibly. So there's not much stability to a river, but still we can talk about a river, and we can go visit the river, and we can give it a name, and we can conventionally understand it as this process. It is a process. No stability there, but we still can kind of refer to it. And so using this kind of analogy with the chariot, this is an assemblage of parts, and it's a conventional name. It's not a thing. When the aggregates exist, there's the convention of being, but no existing of a being. So this is that not taking a stand about myself. Neither existence nor non-existence. It's not that this collection of aggregates, conventionally known as Andrea, doesn't exist, but it doesn't not exist. Neither exists nor not exist. It is simply process. And so here we have the notion of conditionality coming in, the arising of conditions, the falling apart of conditions. And as that's pointed to at the end of the sutta, when he brings in dependent origination, the arising of conditions leads to the arising of experience, the sense cessation of experience, the cessation of conditions, the cessation of certain experience. And then in both the Kacchanagata Sutta and in Vajira Sutta, the next phrase is very similar. I'll read Bhikkhu Bodhi's version of this. So one does not take a stand about myself. One has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising. What ceases is only suffering ceases. Knowledge about this is independent of others. It is in this way that there is right view. One has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising. And here, this word suffering refers to the unreliable nature of experience. That whatever is arising has this unreliable quality. Whatever is ceasing, it's just unreliability ceasing. This phrase whatever arises is only suffering arising. Whatever ceases is only suffering ceasing. That phrase was one that also kept recurring to me on my self-retreat in conjunction with this neither tarrying nor hurrying. They seem to be kind of two sides of a coin. When we understand, when there's that understanding that it's only unreliable experience arising, why would there be any tarrying? Why would there be any hurrying to the next unreliable experience? So these two together form this kind of support for the mind on that retreat. The other phrase that in this week, just in this time on this retreat, that has really lingered with me is that phrase, there's no perplexity or doubt. In the past, I've struggled to find a word or phrase that somehow conveys understanding, what feels like clarity, without using the word clarity, because the word clarity seems to have some particular views connected with it. So many times in talking to people, they say, you know, something like, the experience, it was so clear yesterday and it's not clear today. And in a little bit more probing of the actual experience, there is the possibility of no perplexity or doubt about the experience, but not that sense of, I know exactly what's happening. I know that sensation, that body experience, I know that clearly. I think clarity, the word clarity often comes with a kind of an implication of consciously knowing exactly what's happening. And sometimes that's not the experience, even when there is no perplexity or doubt. There's no perplexity or doubt that there is awareness. No perplexity or doubt that it's just suffering arising. But it may not be, it may be the experience of vagueness, of diffuseness. And so that phrase I found helpful to land with this is what it is to have that clear seeing, no perplexity or doubt. So the ending of the sutta is the Buddha coming back to dependent origination, and it ties in with what he said to Kachana at the beginning. He says, all exists, Kachana, this is one extreme. All does not exist, this is the second extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle. With ignorance as condition, volitional formations come to be. With volitional formations as condition, consciousness, etc. Such is the origin of the whole mass of suffering. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of volitional formations. This is the cessation of consciousness. Such is the cessation of the whole mass of suffering. So pointing to the notion of existence, the notion of non-existence, right in the middle, there's no existence or non-existence. It's conditions coming together and falling apart. Nothing existing, nothing not existing. We can't say either one. We can't take a stand on either side. It is just an ever-changing flux of conditions arising and ceasing. So those are some words from the Buddha and some reflections on those words. And now some questions. So, one of the questions that went up in the last couple days, a question about Sayadaw Utejaniya, his life and his teachings and his monastery. I'll save that one for the end of the retreat. But here's another. I've noticed there are many different kinds of thinking, from daydreaming to planning or other discursive kinds of thoughts. Could you please offer some guidance about what kinds are okay and wholesome versus when you should get off the train, so to speak? This is a big topic. I'll do kind of an overview. My mind is going in multiple directions at this point, try to decide where to land. First, I'll point to one piece of the question, which is how to decide what's wholesome versus when we should get off the train. And the Buddha had a sutta, a discourse on just this question. Two kinds of thought, he called it. And he said he noticed that when he had thoughts that kind of had the underpinnings based in ill will, cruelty, and sense desire, that those were not helpful, that they led to suffering for himself, for other, for both. And he said those kinds of thoughts were not helpful. And then he said, but there are other kinds of thoughts, he said, connected with non-ill will, non-cruelty, and renunciation that, he said, these were not going to cause suffering. He said something like, I could think these thoughts all day and all night and no harm would come from them. But then he reflected, and in thinking those thoughts all day and all night, the mind would become tired and it would be far from concentration. So there's a time for those thoughts and a time not for those thoughts. So he had this kind of distinction of like wholesome thoughts, unwholesome thoughts. And, you know, the unwholesome thoughts, he said, are to be abandoned. And so that would be, you know, unwholesome thoughts, thoughts connected with greed, aversion, delusion, thoughts connected with ill will, with cruelty, thoughts connected with getting what I want, getting rid of what I don't want. Those are thoughts to be abandoned. And yet, as you have experienced, you know, abandoning, when that word, you might just think it means, oh yeah, I stop thinking that thought. I stop having those motivations. I stop going there. Sometimes we can get off that train. Sometimes we can do that. At other times, there's enough momentum or enough of a, it's kind of like those thoughts, those, that kind of train has got such a momentum that it's not possible to say, oh yeah, flip the switch and have that train go away. What we get to do instead is be with the experience of having those thoughts, know how they affect us, know how they affect our minds, know what kind of intentions, what kind of actions they might lead us towards. So we feel the suffering of those kinds of thoughts. And that itself is a kind of abandonment. We are abandoning the engagement with believing their value. We're abandoning the engagement with kind of following that train. And it's like the disengagement of the gears, the mindfulness and wisdom allow a disengagement of the gears. And so it's a whole different thing happening. And so abandonment doesn't necessarily mean that we simply can say, yep, stop thinking that thought. But we do explore the possibility of bringing mindfulness and wisdom to those thoughts. If possible, getting off the train. But not always possible. It's not always possible. And so sometimes we can all do other things, like, you know, anytime we're caught by something challenging and a difficult kind of mind state that feels like a lot of suffering, and it feels like that mind state is stronger than our ability to be aware of it. We've talked about using our tools, using other means to help ourselves disengage, setting it aside, not trying to be mindful of it, because sometimes trying to be mindful of it will just pull us right into the rabbit hole of it. And so there are times when that's what the abandoning is, and not trying to repress it or stop those thoughts, but just say, yep, okay, I'm going to put my attention someplace else, using our tools to help us to not be quite so stuck to those thoughts. And then the other piece that to just speak to is the mentioning of noticing many different kinds of thinking. There are many different kinds of thinking. I mean, not only just the daydreaming and planning, but there's kind of almost different levels of thinking. There's a kind of ordinary level of thinking where we are, you know, actively engaged. We are picking up thoughts and thinking about them. You know, it's like I'm thinking, like this afternoon, thinking about, okay, what am I going to say? Oh, that brings that sutta into mind. It's like consciously engaged with the process. So there's an active component to certain kinds of thinking, an engagement there where there's kind of a choice. We can do that or not do that. Like at certain points, it's like, yep, okay, time to stop for a little bit. My mind is getting a little tired, so let me put it down. So there's a little bit of being able to pick things up and put things down with this kind of highest or most obvious kind of thinking. And then there's some more subtle kinds of thinking that are more along the lines of just thinking arising. Sometimes daydreaming is like this. It's like you're not consciously trying to do daydreaming. It just happens. Sometimes even planning can have that quality. It's like you're kind of just sitting there and suddenly the mind is off in this like almost daydreaming planning kind of thing. And so this is another level of kind of thinking that's not so much that I'm consciously doing, but that their thoughts are arising. These thoughts are conditioned. And so this kind of thought is a little subtler than the kind of thought that we actively think. And it's helpful or interesting at times to notice the difference between the active thinking and this more happening thinking. Sometimes it can be useful to check in. Can I stop this thinking? Do I have a choice in that? Is it a kind of thinking that I can say, yeah, I'm going to put that down for a while? If it's not, if you find that I don't seem to have control over that thinking, rather than being frustrated by the lack of controllability, let that be a lesson of this is not self. I'm not doing this. These are conditions arising. So rather than that very common sense of frustration when the uncontrollability of the mind is revealed, let that uncontrollability point you to not self. This is not self. So another question later, which I will not fully answer, but could you speak more about cultivating the perception of not self? This is one way that we can cultivate the perception of not self. And the reason I'm not going to answer that question so much today is that I'm going to take the next 2 days to answer that question. we're going to go through a bigger kind of exploration of that question over time. But this reflection or this curiosity around, is this a thought that I can stop? No. Wow, it's like just watching dominoes fall. If we can turn to that or recognize the uncontrollability as a manifestation of the not-self nature of those thoughts, that is cultivating that perception of not-self. We are recognizing no control. This is a key way the Buddha pointed to this perception, the uncontrollable nature of experience. So anytime there's frustration with uncontrollability, not-self. So that was a little diversion off of thoughts. But so with the, that's another level of thought, is that kind of thought that just happens. And then there's maybe an even like subtler level of thought, which is not so much about, you know, planning or remembering or stories about my past or my future. Sometimes there's a kind of level of thought that's just like, you know, these random things that, like stories about people you don't know, topics you don't even care about, and you find yourself kind of thinking about these things, and it's like this story, this movie's going on, it's like, who are these people? What's happening here? That is another kind of thought. And again, it's just kind of the mind putting things together and producing a magic show. It's also not self. So, you know, noticing or recognizing these different flavors of thought can be helpful in terms of, you know, actually what seems to happen is that level of thought of the kind of like the magic show of some mind production, that can sometimes indicate there's actually quite a bit of loosening of tension in the mind. It can actually mean the mind is settling into some concentration. That kind of state is often a place where the concentration is getting stronger, but the energy isn't quite at the same level as the concentration, and so we end up in these kind of phantasmagorical thoughts. And so that kind of thought can be a sign of, you know, just a little bit of low energy. And so, you know, just a little bit of like bringing the energy up. And, you know, if we think about the energy as a kind of a dial, like, you know, just a little bit of adjustment of the dial of how much energy gets put in. When that kind of thought is happening, the smallest little adjustment of the dial is usually all that's needed. If you decide, you know, wow, lots of thoughts here, I better go take a walk and, you know, get up and start, you know, doing fast walking to try to settle the mind, you're probably going to spin yourself way into restlessness. Because that state is actually, it's not, the energy and the concentration are not that far apart. Especially if you're recognizing those thoughts. And so sometimes I find just a little bit of like, oh, just slightly straightening the spine. Or maybe getting interested in those thoughts themselves. Oh, phantasmagorical thoughts or, you know, weird thoughts are happening. Just a little bit of interest there can bring the energy up. Some curiosity can bring the energy up. So just the slightest adjustment of that dial. We tend to, you know, have the view that, well, this thinking is a problem, better settle the mind down, pick up some effort to do that. And that tends to be way more effort than's necessary and will tend to spin the mind into agitation. So that's kind of another level of thought, this kind of dreaming thought, basically, like it's just weird dreams, but you're not asleep. You're that's another thing to kind of check into there. Is the body actually, you know, people say, I'm dreaming, I'm asleep. And I'd say, well, is the body actually like this? No, the body is not like that. The body has not fallen down. The body has not slumped. And so if the body has not slumped and that there's some uprightness to the posture, it's not sleep. it's probably more this kind of concentration energy slight imbalance. Another kind of thought that happens is, the story of me. Just this kind of underlying narrative of who I am, what I'm doing. And it's not necessarily planning. That can be a manifestation of it, but we start to see just that our mind is like constantly telling ourselves who I am, what I'm doing. On a retreat, a 3-month retreat, I started seeing this, and I thought I should be able to turn it off. And this is another one of those that is the not self. You know, it's a pointer to not self. And I saw that, you know, it's like just narrating every action that I did. She walked into the bathroom. She turned on the light. She noticed that she thought she turned on the light. She thought about telling Joseph that she noticed that she thought she turned on the light. Mine got kind of like really weird there. So that narration quality, it's like that's a very, it's kind of a subtle level of thought that probably is actually wandering around with us most of the time. It's just subtler than we usually can see. And so when I start seeing that level of thought, it's like, well, there's actually, and when people start telling me they're seeing this kind of thing, they're being driven nuts by this, it's like, well, that actually is a pretty subtle level of thought. That shows quite a bit of continuity of mindfulness to see that kind of thought. So again, it's like we have these ideas about what should be happening, what shouldn't be happening. And that's another kind of thought that we can see often happens as the mind gets more and more settled. And then another form of thought is the perceptual process. Just the mind recognizing things. Sometimes this also appears as a form of thought. We're sitting in the hall and the sound of a bird comes in, and the mind labels it mourning dove or woodpecker or whatever, you know. And sometimes that appears as an actual word in the mind. It can appear as an image. It can appear as a felt sense. It can appear as a, you know, any way that we experience, sense experience, thoughts can be in any of the sense modalities. Often it seems to be in images or words. Some of the two main kind, but another kind of main one is just the experience of the physicality. And this kind of flavor for me comes more in like perceiving or remembering movement. So I used to be a dancer, and I would imagine the dance in my mind, and it was experienced through almost the feeling as if I was doing it. So that's a form of thought, you know, felt through the kinesthetic sense. So the perception can appear in any one of those different ways, any one of those ways. And that's it's a subtle form of thought. And sometimes, again, people come and say, you know, I'm constantly labeling. And again, the question here is, well, is it something you're actively doing? Are you trying to label things? Or is it just happening? You're sitting there and the mind hears the sound of a bird and the mind goes bird. And quite often it's the latter. And again, it's not self. This is the process of perception at work, the process of perception doing its job. And so distinguishing between what we are actively participating in versus what we are witnessing as just a process happening. And that is, again, a pointer to the perception of not self. As we're witnessing the processes of mind at work, just phenomenon coming, and the kind of, it does seem to be pointed to by this confusion of, I can't make this stop. People sometimes come and tell me how to make it stop. How do I make this labeling stop? It's like, well, you're not going to probably be able to make perception stop. We don't actually want perception to stop. It's how we get around the world. So that's kind of a different, you know, different levels, kind of more from the most obvious to the most subtle in terms of forms of thought and different reflections on how to work with them. Mostly, most of those kinds of thoughts, the instruction is, notice you can't control it. Notice it's not self. Can you say some words about patience with others, with ourselves? Patience is a great quality of mind to cultivate. Sometimes I think reflecting on reflections can be a great support for patience. Reflecting on the for others, for instance, you know, that what somebody else is doing, you know, in terms of if we are impatient with somebody else, you know, that what is arising there, they are living out their own conditioning, living that out. And one thing that I find supports patience in this kind of environment is that there's a basic level of trust that everyone is interested in understanding their own conditioning and working with it. It's a little harder sometimes out in the world when we see people just, you know, engaged in their patterns and habits. And, you know, yes, it is all conditioned, but we don't see any interest in an understanding or any interest in that. That kind of requires a higher level of patience in some ways. So here, I think on retreat, we can kind of remember that we are all here with this shared love of the Dharma, shared refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. That, for me at least, supports patience with others. With ourselves, you know, I think this reflection on uncontrollability, that has been a great support for patience. The path that we are on is a gradual path. It unfolds just little by little. The seeing, the understandings happen little by little. And sometimes I think impatience about ourselves, about our own growth and development comes because we're not seeing change, what we think, fast enough. We're not seeing growth fast enough. So it feels like there's a kind of a frustration that comes up, or I must be doing it wrong. There must be something I can do so that I can have the signposts that I want that say, yes, it's good, you're making progress. We so want that sense of signposts of helping us say, yes, you're making progress. And, you know, there can be times in practice when it really feels like nothing is happening. You know, nothing. I mean, nothing in terms of a sense of we're not seeing what we're learning. We're not seeing what we're understanding. And we don't trust that there's a kind of an understanding happening somewhere underneath. There's a couple of images that I find useful for this reflection. The first one I'll offer is from Gill. He speaks of kind of like the practice being like you're chopping wood. And so there's an aim, you're trying to do something, you know, you're trying to go somewhere, you're trying to split this wood. So this is one way, you know, so I'm going to give different ways of thinking about this analogy because they bring up different pieces of the way things happen. So in this case, you know, there's the activity of chopping the wood. You bring the hammer down, the hammer, the axe down on the wood, and you hit it, and nothing happens. The wood doesn't split. So you try again. It doesn't happen. You maybe see little tiny lines in the top, you know. So you see, well, okay, yeah, but that's not making much progress. Keep going. And at some point, the wood just cleaves open. And we think that we did it just right that time. And we think, oh, that was how I was, if I had done that the first time, it would have worked. But Gill says, you know, no, actually, every single time you hit that wood, it was weakening the fiber inside the wood. You just can't see that happening. Every single time you hit the wood was necessary for that last one to split the wood. And so even though we can't see that weakening happening, the weakening of the greed, aversion, delusion at times, it still feels so much the same. Trusting that this, I think patience and trust come together. We learn to trust over time. And I think looking back on our practice too is helpful as we can reflect back. Yes, there has been development. There has been, this life is so different than it was 10 years ago or 5 years ago, however long it's been. You know, that we see that there has been change and a trust that, yes, this practice is valuable. It does lead to understanding. And the more we practice, the more we see, as the Dalai Lama says, to look at things in terms of 5 or 10 or 15 year increments and not like, oh, how about last sitting? How about this sitting? Any progress? It's not usually seen at that level. Like every now and then, there's something we see clearly and it's well understood. But there are lots of times in practice where there's not a lot of, you know, clarity about what's being understood. And yet there can be no perplexity or doubt that something is being understood. So the trust in the practice grows, and that supports patience. That's a great support for patience. I don't have time for the other analogies. So there are many questions I didn't get to. There were so many questions this time. I will continue to bring them in to the talks, and maybe I'll do some of them in the mornings also to kind of make sure that we receive these questions and reflect on them together. So let's sit for a moment.